This has been one of my favorite passages in the book of Jeremiah for many, many years. I think it's the beginning of a new speech. Thus saith Jehovah, stand ye in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths, where is the good way, and walk therein, and you shall find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk therein. Stand in the ways, that was the ways of idolatry, the ways of men, the ways of wickedness. Ask for the old paths, where the good way, that carries them back to Mount Sinai, the giving of the law, and even before that, the good men of the pre-Mosaic days. Walk therein, but they said, we'll not walk therein. Children of Israel were in strict rebellion against God. They would not listen to Jeremiah, wouldn't listen to God. But I keep in mind that during this period, Josiah, one of the, in fact, the last good king that Judah ever had, he was breaking down the idol altar and breaking down the idols. He was trying to remove the external part of their apostasy. Jeremiah was working on the heart. Josiah was having a lot more success than Jeremiah was. You can break down a building, you can break down an altar, but that's one thing. To change the heart of a man the way he serves God, that's another thing. And so I think sometimes in our Reformation movements break down the idols without getting to the heart of the individual. That could be true at today. Well, he moves on from that. And I set watchmen, God says, over you, saying, hearken to the sound of the trumpet. But they said, we will not hearken. Now, Numbers, the 10th chapter, the first 10 verses, God told Moses to make two silver trumpets. They were to sound one of them, that meant move forward. Then sometimes you sounded both of them together, that meant something else. And another sound meant a warning. I mean, two of them, prepare for battle. At any rate, the trumpet was blown to sound an alarm to get the folks moving forward, also to stir them up for war, all these various things that they would do. Right in, sir, come right in. I was glad to see you again with us this morning, sir, with your son, grandson. We're in the sixth chapter of the book of Jeremiah, 6:16-17. And blow the trumpet. They said, we will not hearken. That is, I think this was a trumpet of warning. When the enemy was approaching, they were to warn them by the trumpets. I believe that the sounding of the seven trumpets in Revelation teaches the same thing. It was sounding a warning of a judgment about to begin. The seven trumpets warn. The seven bowls of wrath suggest a finality of the judgment against which they had been warned. So it is now. So here's the warning, but they say we will not heed it. Or it may have been sometimes a call to an assembly, worship. They said, no, we won't do that either. They're not going to listen to God and make it what happens. Therefore, hear ye nations. Now notice, he called the nations now to listen. And before we get through, when we come to the last part of this book, there's another Bible up here on front, too, if you... he issues his judgments against the nations. Now, when he calls the nations to listen, that means that when he deals with his people, he will deal with them. But he's calling them, I think, to witness as much as anything else here. Therefore, hear ye nations, and know, O congregation, what is among them. That's what, know what's among the nations and among the people of God there, what's happening, all of which would call forth a judgment from God. He moves on, hear, O earth, behold, I will bring evil upon this people, even the fruit of their thoughts, because they have not hearkened unto my words. And as for my law, they have rejected it. Now, these are serious charges against God's people there. You've rejected his law. You're living, it is the fruits of your own evil thoughts here. And you rejected the Lord and you rejected His Word. You won't listen to Him. And when men won't listen to God, then comes the fruit of that rebellion. Whatever a man sows, that's what he reaps. To what purpose cometh there to me frankincense from Sheba and the sweet cane from a far country? Now Sheba was that land down in the southeast corner of the Arabian Peninsula. You remember the Arabian, the Red Sea came up on one side, and I forget the what on the other side of the Arabian Sea. But at any rate, the Arabian Desert, I mean, that country, that southeast corner of the Sheba was, well, I don't know, 1,000 or 1,200 miles from Jerusalem. But they would bring this incense, frankincense, that was used in the incense they burned unto the Lord. And this sweet cane, or it's called calamus here on the side, calamus, some kind of a plant that they used also in their incense that they burned. That incense had to be made with very definite substances and after a certain fashion, so a certain amount of each there. And it was a very precious thing, that incense was. But what does it amount to? Now, notice that your burnt offerings are not acceptable, nor your sacrifice is pleasant unto me. Now, they're not the ones that God authorized. I want you to keep that in mind now for just a moment. He goes on to say here, therefore thus saith Jehovah, behold, I will lay stumbling blocks before this people, and the fathers and the sons together shall stumble against them. The neighbor and his friend shall perish. Right now, thus saith Jehovah, behold, a people coming from the north country, and a great nation shall be stirred up from the uttermost parts of the earth. Right, now these are the Babylonians. Great and powerful nation to the north of them, northeast. They're going to be stirred up and they're going to come against you here. That is what he's warning them now, what's coming. Now notice they lay hold on bow and spear. They are cruel and have no mercy. Their voice roareth like the sea, and they ride upon horses, every one set in array as a man to the battle against thee, O daughter of Zion. Right now, they won't listen to God, but he said, now, the roar of the sea, that is, the horses and the chariots are rumbling along. There's a roar of the sea now, and the sea will overflow you and destroy you. It's a warning to them. Now, that's what I think the trumpet was. The trumpet was a warning. They said, we won't listen to it. I think the trumpets are sounding in this country. I think what we see is just simply a warning of a total collapse or a fall after a while. The judgment is inevitable when people follow the pattern of life that we followed and which they followed back there. Right, now then the prophet joins himself with the people now and he says, we have heard the report thereof. Our hands waxed feeble, anguish had taken hold of us, and pangs as of a woman in travail. Yet they were terrified. And they heard of the coming of the Babylonians, they terrified them, but they refused to listen to God. Now then they're on their way. It's going to be too late now. Too late. Go not forth into the field, nor walk by the way, for the sword of the enemy and terror on every side. Now, there were three different invasions by the Babylonians. There was one in 605 when Nebuchadnezzar followed the Assyrians west as far as Haran, and then he paused there and then moved on south and took parts of Judah. And he carried back with him, that's when he carried Daniel and the three friends of Daniel and others in that 605 invasion. Right, and I move on now. O daughter of my people, gird thee with sackcloth and wallow thyself in ashes. Make thee mourning as for an only son. Most bitter lamentation, for the destroyer shall suddenly come upon us. Now notice it's going to come upon us. He identifies himself with those upon whom it's going to come. It's upon all of us. So the righteous will not escape it. they're going to suffer too. That's a problem that's confused people for a long time. Why is it that the righteous suffer with the wicked? That's one of the prices that we pay for living in a world where men have the right to choose. I choose to live where I live. I choose to live the kind of life that I live. So my neighbor here, and I've chosen the life in Christ. Now he hasn't. Here then all around us are individuals who have chosen to serve Satan. They're not interested in God. They're rejecting God. And upon that last Sunday morning, they're rejecting God. Now, when the judgment comes upon them as a result of my choice to live in this country among them, I don't know where else I'd live, can't find a place where I aren't, well, I've got to pay the price with them for that right to live among people who choose. So, and also, I choose to do certain things. Sometimes I suffer as a result of my own choices. I think all suffering is a consequence of the violation of law. The violation of all law is the result of choices that individuals make. Now, I may not be conscious of the law that I violated, a physical law, but I violated physical laws. I suffer physically as a result of that. I may not know what the law was when I violated it, but it's always the consequence of the violation of law. Either I violated it, or I'm suffering the consequence of somebody else's violation of it. Right? So now then, when the judgment comes upon a nation, here the righteous then, they suffer because the wicked have violated God's law, brought the judgment upon them. But now that's a test of my faith. When that judgment comes, my faith is put to the test. Will I hold on to God, or will I give up? And so these are some of the things I hope that I've made, have presented in such a way during the years I've been teaching out here, that you are conscious of that, and that when a judgment hits this country, that you have your faith in God and hold on to that faith in God, irrespective of how much you may suffer, along with the suffering of others who are suffering the consequence of their choices. Hold on to it, because you've got something better out beyond. They don't. You've got a heavenly home out there beyond this. So what difference does it make if an atomic bomb hits down here and I go with the first crowd? So what? I've got a better home than I had here anyway. And these judgments come on the wicked, but the righteous suffer consequences of their wickedness along with them. Not the guilt, consequence. Any question on that? Anybody want to ask a question or add anything to it? All right. Now he moves on. Now he says to the prophet, I have made thee a trial, or the footnote says a tower. The word there is uncertain as to what it was. Now, I think the word try means I'm using you as one to try or test the faith of these people by preaching. A try there, and a fortress among my people. So he will be that thou mayest know and try their way. All right, so Jeremiah is a preacher, while preaching the word of God, that was trying or testing their faith. Puts them to the test there. Or if it's a tower or a fortress, then what you're preaching is that wherein you can take refuge. So just which he meant is uncertain, but either one of them is true. His preaching was a test, a trial of their faith. On the other hand, if they took refuge in it, then it was as taking refuge in a fortress. God provided fortress here. And that's the same way it'll be with us. When the judgment comes and people are preaching the word of God and trying to get people to turn to God, it'll be a test of their faith. It's a test of it now. All right, now they're all grievous revolters. And that's to cast off all allegiance. Revolt against God. Cast off the allegiance of God. Going about with slanders. They're brass and iron. They all of them deal corruptly. Hard, brash, and iron. In other words, they've hardened their heart against God. They become hard, cold individuals. Right? The bellows blow fiercely. The lead is consumed in the fire. and in vain do they go on refining, for the wicked are not kept awake. All right, so here then, God's preaching and God's judgments are as a refining fire. Said the bellows of oil are going fast now, and the fire is furious, and the lead's being melted, but there ain't any silver there. No gold, they're not finding any. Because nothing but dross. I know the next verse, refuse silver shall men call them, because Jehovah hath rejected them. Now refuse silver, that's the slag, that's the cast off, that's the part that is no silver in it. So the bellows are trying, the fire's getting hot, God testing his people, but he's finding no silver or gold. He's finding nothing there but dross among them. Now, that's a terrible charge. Terrible charge, but that's where it was. Well, now that concludes that one when he called them to stand in the ways you're traveling. Look for the old path, where's the good way, walk therein. You find rest for your soul. Say, we'll not walk therein. God said, the trumpet sounded. They said, we won't listen to the trumpet. All right, so if you won't listen to God and what he says, the only inevitable thing left is the consequence. And that's always been that way. It'll always be that way. That God is calling upon men today. Men today are refusing God. They're rejecting God. Right? So what's the inevitable consequence? Reaping as they have sown. And so our fall is on its way. I don't know when, don't know how it'll come. I just know from what God's done in the past, it's on its way. God doesn't change. We're going to point out in a moment, in our next lesson. All right, so that concludes that section now. All right, so he moves on now in the seventh chapter here to their worship. What they were doing was about like a lot of folks are today. They were saying the temple, the temple, the temple. That is here, the temple, we're in the presence of the temple. The temple's in our midst. God's not going to allow that temple to be destroyed. And that's the great temple Solomon built. God's not going to let that be destroyed. Right, so then that trust was in what? In the temple. In that which they had made themselves. They had made that. All right? So today I think we say, oh, the church, the church, the church. I remember the church. I go to church on Sunday. All that. That's fine if it has any meaning. If it doesn't have any meaning, it doesn't mean anything. It's the meaning back of it that counts. What's my real relation to God? What's my attitude toward God? Where is God? Is God the center, or have we put something else in the center of our lives? This has impressed me for a good many years now, the study of the Bible. I've been trying to preach it, and I've said it many, many times here, that life, God has to be the center of life around which all else revolves. God's not going to be out here on the perimeter and put money or pleasure here and then stick God out here on the perimeter somewhere. God's going to be the center, or he's not going to be there. And that's the point that Jeremiah's making. That's the point the New Testament makes. That's the point I've been trying to make in my preaching for 60 years now, ever since I learned it, is that life has to be centered in God and revolve around him in Christ. All right, now, the word that came to Jeremiah from Jehovah saying, stand in the gate of Jehovah's house and proclaim there the word and say. Now here's what you say. Hear the word of Jehovah, all ye of Judah, that enter in at these gates to worship Jehovah. All right, now here was the temple, and now you stand at the gate and you preach to them and they come in. Now, don't you know that was irritated those Jews? Here we were coming into worship. Here's old Jeremiah standing here. I don't know how old he was. Here's Jeremiah standing here preaching to us on the outside here. Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. You've got to mend your doings. Come into the temple to worship, not going to do it unless you amend your ways. You see, religion is made up of faith in God and what he has done and doing what he said do. Also, it's made up of the life of the individual. What's this life like? Alright? I will cause you to dwell in this place. Trust you not in lying words, saying, the temple of Jehovah, the temple of Jehovah, the temple of Jehovah are these. Well, here, this is the temple of Jehovah here. We're in the midst of the temple of Jehovah here, these buildings here. Well, nothing going to happen to us here. God's going to now allow his temple to be destroyed. They just didn't know him, did they? They sure did. That's right. That was a fact. That was a fault. All right, so here's the church. God's not going to allow members of his church to be lost. They're not going to mean any more to God unless they've done right than anybody else. It'll really be a little worse because they denied him. At any rate, he moves on. Now he goes on to say here, temple to temple. For if you thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if you thoroughly execute justice between a man and his neighbor, if you oppress not the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, and shed not innocent blood in this place, neither walk after other gods to your own hurt, then will I cause you to dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers from of old, even forevermore. Now the temple is wonderful. The place to meet is wonderful. All that. But when we put our trust in a building, and I think a lot of people do that. I think a lot of members of the church don't know the difference between the church and the meeting house there. And we've got a nice building. We've got a service. We hold to the pattern. We keep five acts of worship, which the Bible said nothing about. All that sort of thing. Well, that's fine, but what's back of it? Well, where's your heart? You see what he's talking about? You see what religion really is? What Christianity really is? It's a God-centered, Christ-centered life. Everything revolving by us, man. That's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And because you're once lost, you're not always lost. And once saved, not always saved.
They think that they're once gone into the church, that they're not, they might say,
"Oh, that's correct." You're right on that. So it's what you are and where you're going to be spent depends on you, and what I am depends on me. What I am, what I'm, choices I make. Ezekiel teaches that so clearly that when a man dies, that's what he faces God, either in fellowship or out of fellowship. All right, moving on. Now then, this place forevermore. Behold, you trust in lying words that cannot profit. Those who trust in that idea that I'm once saved, I'm always saved, that's a lying word. Just as false as it can be. All right. Will you steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and burn incense unto Baal, walk after other gods that you have not known, and come and stand before me in this house which is called with my name, and say, we are delivered, that you may do all these abominations? That is the fact. I'm a member of the church. I remember, that's fine if it means anything, but it's got to mean something. So here you steal, commit adultery, violate the Ten Commandments that were on the back there. Then you come into the temple here and offer a sacrifice and say, we're not justified. No, there's got to be a change of heart, change of life, for an not to mean anything. For that person, it doesn't. We're delivered. You may do all of this. But now notice what he says. Now, we're delivered, that you may do all these things. Well, can you do all these things and be delivered by simply coming into the house where my house, a house of worship? This house which is called by my name become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, I have seen it, said Jehovah. I've seen it. I see what you're doing. I've seen every bit of it. I know what you're doing by Ashon every day. What you're doing. I know how little it means to come in here into this temple and worship. The library of the temple was. Now this, I think, is a very fine lesson, a very fine chapter on what real religion is. It's more that it's the externals to it, yes. God ordained the sacrifices. God ordained it. And when David wanted to build this temple, and God wouldn't let it, he said Solomon would build it. And so then Solomon built it. Well, and the dedication, the Shekinah, this glory of God filled the temple there. God took him to residence there. But now, when you come over to Ezekiel, the 11th chapter, that's where God left the temple. Yeah, his presence came up, came all here over the place, moved on over east here to the mount, to the east there, and he left it. So then Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed it. God had left it when he did. Jesus Christ left it when the Romans destroyed it. He had left it. So when God destroys a thing, when he leaves it, no longer fits him to dwell, that way he destroys it. Now he moves on to a thought here. Therefore pray not thou for this people, neither lift up cry nor prayer for them, neither make intercession to me, for I will not hear thee. All right, there comes a time beyond which you can pray for an individual. I don't know when that time comes. I know what John said in 1 John 5 there about praying for certain individuals. I've known individuals that I wouldn't pray for them, and yet it's hard not to pray for them, for you really don't know. But sometimes a person comes back, sometimes he doesn't. But there reaches a time beyond which you can pray for an individual. Now that's three times he said that. I don't want to look at the other. Turn over here to 11:14. 11:14 have it again here. Therefore pray not thou for this people, neither lift up cry nor prayer for them, for I will not hear them in the time that they cry unto me because of their trouble. A second time there. Well, now look at 14:11. 14:11, again, same thing. And Jehovah said unto me, pray not for this people, for they are good. When they fast, I will not hear their cry. And when they offer burnt offering and meal offering, I will not accept them, but I will consume them by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence. They've reached a point of no return. Three different times they don't pray for this people. So, Brother C.R. Nichol, it is said of him, I don't remember whether he told me or somebody told me, he had a friend down there in Texas where he lived, at that town down where he lived for so long. Then he was a lawyer, member of the church. He left the Lord, went on, became very worldly. And Nichol talked to him several times about it. We were friends. So this fellow was got sick, was going to die. He couldn't get well. Called for Nichol, come in and pray for him. Nichol to pray. Nichol said, I can't pray for you. So I tried to talk to you back on it when you could turn to the Lord. Now that you chose not to, now that I'm not going to, can't pray for you now, when you're facing a final end. That'd take a lot of courage, didn't it? I don't know whether I could have done that or not. I don't know. But I think he was right. And you're right. Now he's praying then, too late. Had his opportunity, didn't take it. Now he's facing the judgment, facing the fires of hell, and the judgment of God, and all that. Now they don't want a little fire insurance. Did he really love the Lord? Was it really a turning to God? Or was it a little fire insurance? I've got a cousin in law, died a short time ago, oh, 2 or 3 years now. Went to church, never would obey the gospel. His wife's going for a long time. He finally got to going with her. But the night before he died, his two boys talked with him a long time. They persuaded him to be baptized. He died the next day. I'm going to leave him with God. I'm not going to pass judgment on him. But I have my very serious doubt. He was not an 11th hour man. An 11th hour person. You remember Jesus said he was an 11th hour. He gave him the same wages. But the 11th hour man accepted the opportunity the first time he heard it. First time he had an opportunity to go work in that vineyard, he went. Now this boy, man had been listening to it for years and years, raised in Methodist, I believe he was, and heard the gospel all those years. Now he comes to die. We'll get him an asbestos suit. I just don't believe God provides him. I have no confidence forever what we call death bed repentance. Of all the comments in the world, and the fellow that does it, this first time I had an opportunity. Now, if this is the first time anybody ever told him what he ought to do, that's a different thing. First time he heard it. But he rejected all through the years, then come down to the end now. Now he wants God to save him. Will he? You're going to leave that with him. I'm not going to pass the judgment, but I wouldn't give much for religion like that. Now look at what he goes. Therefore pray not for them, he says. Seest thou what they do in the cities here? what they do in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem. Now notice, whole families involved, whole in the idolatry. Now notice here, the children gather wood, the fathers kindle the fire, and the women knead the dough to make cakes to the Queen of Heaven, and to pour out drink offerings unto other gods, that they may provoke me to anger. All of them involved. The children gather the sticks for the father. The father lights the fire, gets the thing going. The woman needs the dough there, put it on there to make the offer of cakes to the Queen of Heaven. Don't know who the Queen of Heaven was. That was Ashtaroth, probably. But she was a queen there of the goddesses. At any rate, it was an act of idolatry, and all of them engaged in it. Now here then, you want to do that kind of worship, live the kind of an immoral life you described up here, then you want to come into the temple and say everything's all right with us now with God, because we're coming to the temple. So the Lord's Supper, a lot of folks seem to need, and in my years of preaching, have seemed to have the idea, if I can just go on Sunday morning and break a little piece of bread and drink a little wine there, that cleanses me of all my sins and all that. No, it's not a cleanser. It's a memorial. It binds me to communion with him. If I'm not in fellowship with him, there's no communion there. And so just eating the Lord's Supper doesn't save a person within itself. It's got to be the meaning back of it. All right? So here he goes on to say now, do they provoke me to anger? Do they provoke me to anger, and said Jehovah? Do they not provoke themselves to the confusion of their own faces? They provoke themselves. They move themselves to the confusion of their own faces. Yes, they provoke God, all right, but it's more than that. It's what they're doing to themselves. Therefore, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, mine anger and my wrath shall be poured out upon this place, upon man and upon beast and upon the trees of the field and upon the fruit of the ground, and it shall burn and shall not be quenched. Fire goeth before his face and burneth up the adversary. That's what's going to happen here. God's anger and wrath, that's not just simply like yours and mine to lose his temple. No, this is a judicial wrath, a righteous anger, a righteous indignation at having insulted and rejected God. Micah said, I'll pour out my wrath upon the white water. And he did, like he said, poured out upon him. Terrible picture, isn't it? People say, I can't believe in that kind of a God. I've mentioned the old gentleman down in Temple Terrace a lot of times. I talked to him about the Bible. I mentioned to him before. Oh, Brother Healy said, I just couldn't believe in a God like the God of the Old Testament. Couldn't believe in Paul. I might be able to believe in Jesus. And he said, I couldn't believe in God. I just told Mr. Mack, you don't know anything about either one of them. God of the Old Testament, God of the New Testament, is one God. That's all. Here you see his anger and wrath in one field. You see his love and mercy in another. It's the same God. God doesn't change from one generation to another. We're going to talk about it after a while. All right, it shall burn and shall not be quenched. All right, the fierceness of his anger. The Bible talks about that as well. In writing the commentary on Job, I hope it is supposed to come out this month. I don't know whether it will or not. I haven't read from it. At any rate, when I came to that crocodile and hippopotamus there, what did they represent? Why did Job bring them into it? I was wrestling with that, and the thought occurred to me from Romans 1 and 20. For the invisible things of him are clearly seen, being perceived through the things that are made, even his everlasting power and divinity. Here are things made. What do they reveal? The crocodile reveals God in his wrath. The hippopotamus reveals God in his strength. I mean, the strength of God. But the other animals were all playing around him. There was no fear in his presence when you're in his pasture, or rather when you're doing what you're doing is right. I think that was the teaching of those two animals there. Clearly seen certain invisible things. Invisible, God's invisible strength, power, but also God's invisible wrath, God's invisible tenderness and mercy there. So, the two sides to God's nature. And we must recognize it. Today, the emphasis is always on love, God's love. And they don't know what it means. They don't know what it is. People talk about it with no comprehension of what that love really comprehends. So he moves on. I shall not be quenched. Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, the God of Israel, add your burnt offerings unto your sacrifices, and eat ye flesh. For I spake not unto your fathers, nor commanded them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt, concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. But this thing I commanded them, saying, hearken unto my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people. And now, that doesn't mean God didn't authorize those sacrifices. He did authorize all of them. But the point is, I wasn't just inaugurating a bunch of sacrifices just to offer sacrifices. Back of it was your relationship to me, and this indicated my remission of sins and a sacrifice acceptable. What he's saying is, it never entered my mind to have laws of sacrifices as you're conducting them here. That's the thing that entered his mind. He was the author of all of the Old Testament sacrifices and worship. But it never entered my mind to have for anything like you making it, just simply the offering of sacrifices without any meaning to them. I think that's the only way I can see that, because I know that Jeremiah endorsed the sacrifices and all that. And I know God didn't contradict himself, but I know that God authorized those sacrifices under Moses, but God authorized them for one meaning and one significance, and not that which they were making of. Now notice what he goes on to say. But you shall be my people, and walk ye in all the way that I command you, that it may be well with you. That's the thing. Now, it's not just simply going through the form of offering sacrifices that's going to be acceptable and make you acceptable with me. It's the meaning associated with it. That's the same thing in any worship today. Singing or praying or eating the Lord's Supper, whatever it may be, that within itself is not the thing that saves a person. Is that relationship with God that finds expression in doing this which he said do. Am I making myself clear? Is that your understanding of it? It must be. Has to be. But they hearken not, nor incline their ear, but walked in their own counsels, and in the stubbornness of their own heart, and went backward and not forward. Since the day that your fathers came forth out of the land of Egypt unto this day, I have sent unto you all my servants the prophets, daily rising up early and sending them, yet they hearken not unto them, unto me, nor incline their ear, but made their necks stiff. They did worse than their fathers. Alright, so yeah, I raised up my prophets. Now remember this, when the judgment fell on Judah, and they were carried away into Babylonian captivity, the temple was destroyed, the city was razed to the ground, and they spent 50 years in Babylon serving that nation. They'd been already 20 years under them before that. So that made the 70 years. So now then, during that time, they were, and all of that, now, that was a result of having rejected God and all of that. So those years spent there was a result of what they themselves had done. They'd become stiff, they'd stiffen their necks against God, that it was worse than their fathers. Got all the oil. What a thing to say was. Remember, when all that happened, it was a righteous judgment. God had given them his law, the 10,000 things of his law, and Hosea said they'd become a strange thing to him. And now then God gave them the law. He gave them and sent the prophets to them. Not just one, not just two, but prophet after prophet. He raised up early and sent them early to them before they'd gone so far that there were no turning back. But they kept rejecting God and rejecting his law and rejecting his word. Now then, what kind of a judgment did they receive? A just and righteous judgment. God always does. God doesn't change. My lesson this morning is the unchangeable God. God doesn't change. There were things associated with it. All right? And thou shalt speak all these words unto them, but they will not hearken to thee. Thou shalt also call unto them, but they will not answer thee. You'll talk, but they won't hear you. You'll call, but they won't answer. You'll get no response from them. And thou shalt say unto them, this is the nation that hath not hearkened to the voice of Jehovah their God, nor received instruction. Truth is perished, and cut off from their mouth. They rejected the truth, perished as far as they're concerned. Now, when a nation reaches that point, class, it has reached a point that is no longer fit to live. God had done so much for this nation. It's not saying as those people back then. They were God's people. This has just been a nation, but God's the God of all nations. God has blessed this nation as no other nation has ever been blessed. Now then, what's happening today? God is being rejected. God is being rejected today in almost every phase of our life, even among most religions. It's simply a social gospel, not the preaching of the gospel of Christ Jesus. And once in a while you hear a man that does some good preaching. But so much of the preaching today, from a denominational point of view, is empty, and a lot of it from our own brethren point of view is empty. Lord of real substance. All that. So when God is rejected, the people are no longer fit to live. And we are fast approaching that point. Too fast. All right. Now let's finish the chapter. Cut off thy hair, O Jerusalem, and cast it away, and take up a lamentation on the bare heights, for Jehovah hath rejected and forsaken the generation of his wrath. Now, here it is, as she's a virgin daughter of God, God he calls her. Now, like back in the sixth chapter of Numbers, in the Nazarite vow, the individual touched something unclean. He wanted to cut his hair off during the time of the Nazarite, touched something unclean. He had to cut off his hair, burn it, start over again. And what you've done, the life has been the one of total uncleanness. Now then, cut off your hair and burn it. Because you're going to be as a harlot out here on the bare mountains because of what you've done in this. For the children of Judah have done that which is evil in my sight, said Jehovah. They have set their abominations in the house which is called by my name to defile it. That is, Ahaz and Manasseh had set idols there. And they have built the high places of Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to burn their sons and their daughters in the fire. And make them go through the fire there. That was a light that was practiced by the Canaanites in worshiping the god Moloch. They would burn their firstborn to that god. Now you've even done that. Manasseh and Ahaz both had their sons pass through the fire. Whether they were too fire and that indicated purifying, or whether they actually burned them, is a question among scholars. I don't really know. Which I commanded not, neither came it into my mind ever to do a thing like that. So what you've done is just simply that I never entered my mind, God said, that you'd do a thing like this. Now that doesn't mean God doesn't know all things. It's just an expression that we all use. Well, it never entered my mind to carry that out. Therefore, behold, the days come, saith Jehovah, that it shall no more be called Topheth, nor the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter. For they were shall bury in Topheth. That was the valley, beautiful valley, it's kind of a garden valley, just south and a little bit west of Jerusalem there, the south of it. And there's where they burned Moloch. But now then, Josiah defied it by making it a place of refuge, where they had burned the trash there. But it come to pass, and the dead bodies of this people shall be food for the birds of the heavens and for the beasts of the earth, and none shall frighten them away. Then will I cause to cease from the cities of Judah and from the streets of Jerusalem the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, for the land shall become a waste. Here they are buried down here in this valley of Hinnom. They're buried there until no place to bury, and they're just leave the body there for the birds, for the vultures, and for the wild animals. Terrible picture, isn't it? But the Valley of Hinnom? Our word Gehenna in the Greek comes from the Valley of Hinnom in the Hebrew. Right, so now then, since Josiah made it a place to burn refuse and to cast these bodies there to be burned and all that, that becomes the symbol of hell. The word hell is from the word Gehenna, the final eternal place of the wicked there. And that idea was taken from the valley of Hinnom, where the filth and the refuse of the city was burned. And the fire was kept burning all the time. So that fire burned all the time, so the fires of hell would burn all the time. Not a very pretty picture, is it? But for the fearful and the unbelieving and the abominable and the murderer and the fornicator, the sorcerer, the idolater, and all liars, their part shall be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, the second death. Who wants to spend eternity with a motley crowd like that, in a place like that? That's the ultimate destiny of the wicked.